across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning, everyone. The health service very much on the agenda today. The handover times between a patient being with the Northern Ireland Ambulance Service and them getting into a hospital. This report is just shocking. The question is, what do we do about it? It's not just for the ambulance service. There are questions for them. It's not just for the health service, although there are big questions for the minister. It's for all of us as a community. What do we do about this? So all unfolding on the programme this morning. The Stephen Nolan Show! Good morning. Thanks for joining us today. Look, you're going to hear some shocking statistics this morning, and you're going to hear the authorities, the Northern Ireland Ambulance Service, say sorry and say that it's wrong. And they're also going to be saying that this is a joined up approach that is needed to fix the horrendous handover delays that there are for some patients in Northern Ireland. I think we need to get beyond that, don't we? We need to get to a stage where this is getting fixed. And maybe you and I and everyone else are part of that problem. How quickly can change be affected in Northern Ireland? Because the situation is dire. 3,800 patients potentially subjected to severe harm last year as a result of ambulance handover delays. Over 36,000 instances in 23-24 when patients experienced some harm. These are just two of the stark figures in a Northern Ireland Audit Office report which has just been published. It's found, now wait for this, just 7% of ambulance handovers here were completed within the 15-minute target last year. That is in contrast to England, where 37% of handovers were completed within the 15-minute window in the same period. So in England, if you're living there, 37% of handovers will hit the target, and that's not good enough. They're saying that in England, that that's not good enough. And here in Northern Ireland, you're not getting anywhere close to 37% hitting a target performance. It's just 7. Earlier this morning on Good Morning Ulster, they spoke to the Auditor General, Dorina Carvel.
The number of deaths of people waiting on an ambulance has risen from 4 to 31 over the last 4 years. So significant impacts on patient safety and also significant impacts on costs. As you said in your introduction there, over the last 5 years, the ambulance service has lost £50 million due to these delays. That's an 80% increase in the five-year period. And if we look at just last year alone, 25% of the operational capacity of our ambulance service was lost due to these delays. And that really means just ambulances sitting outside EDs waiting to hand over patients, and therefore they can't respond to other urgent calls.
Now, if it's happened to you, we want to hear from you today. 03030 80 55 55 is the number to call this morning. 03030 80 55 55. Claire Smales has an 88-year-old dad, Robert, who was suffering from dementia. And Robert's waited 23 hours for an ambulance in January. She spoke to Sarah on Good Morning this morning.
On New Year's Eve, my father had a fall in his care home. About 11:30 in the morning, I got a phone call to say that an ambulance had been called. So I raced up there to see him, hoping to kind of rush off in the ambulance. And it was actually 23 hours before the ambulance arrived. So my dad was there overnight. We tried phoning as his condition kind of went downhill, but nobody was able to kind of speed up the ambulance. So he didn't actually arrive at the hospital until sort of 24 hours after the fall. And then we were outside the department for another 9 hours in the ambulance.
And then another 8 hours inside the ED before he was actually admitted.
Yes. Okay. I think we got up to the ward sometime around 3 or 4 a.m. Yeah. So it was quite a mission. It was quite a long time. My dad's 88, so it was It was a bit of an ordeal by that point.
It's not just the ambulance service that is under scrutiny and criticism this morning. When ambulances arrive at the emergency departments, crews and staff are jointly responsible for completing an ambulance handover as quickly and as effectively as possible. So if the ambulance arrives at the hospital in a timely manner, but the hospital can't cope because the hospital's bunged and there are no beds and there are no places, then that is what is reflecting on these ambulance times. Dr. Nigel Ruddle is Medical Director of the Northern Ireland Ambulance Service. I've been speaking to Nigel this morning, and I put it to him that this report is shocking.
It absolutely does, although I have to say it's a report that we welcome, Stephen. For a long time, including on your show, we have been trying to highlight this issue, and particularly delayed handovers of patients from ambulances into hospitals after we arrive at hospital, and the impact that this has both on the patients waiting in the back of the ambulance, waiting for definitive care, also on our staff who are spending long times, often past the end of their shift, looking after these patients. But probably most crucially, Stephen, those at the biggest risk, the patients out in the community who are waiting for a response to an emergency, which is delayed because of this very issue.
And Nigel, there might be some people this morning hearing you and some of your colleagues saying you welcome this report, and yet you are responsible for a timely service. The Northern Ireland Ambulance Service have a responsibility, surely, to look at themselves and see if they can do anything about the 3,800 patients subjected to severe harm last year as a result of ambulance handover delays. You're not immune from scrutiny over this.
No, and we have always said, Stephen, and I've said it repeatedly in your show, that we are really sorry when we are not able to deliver the kind of care that we would want to and that patients deserve. However, I think the report brings out very clearly that so much of this is outside of the control of the ambulance service, not just in Northern Ireland, but where the same issues are faced right across the UK. But there's no doubt particularly so in Northern Ireland that we do our best to respond to patients in a timely fashion. We go out as an emergency, transfer patients in as an emergency, and then unfortunately when we arrive at a hospital that is incredibly busy, the whole thing just slows down and we are powerless at that point. If there is no space in the hospital to bring the patients in, there really is nothing that we can do. So this we really see as a helpful report to shed light on the issue and to hopefully give some impetus to change occurring.
So there's nothing the Northern Ireland Ambulance Service can do. This is going to happen again.
That's not true, Stephen. I mean, there are things.
That's what you've just said.
No, the biggest issue is the handover. There are things, and they're highlighted in the report, there are things that we have been doing and things we can continue to improve on, in particular finding alternatives to bringing people to hospital, which has improved even since the report was written. You know, we've seen significant improvement and investment in that, so that we're actually only bringing around 75% of patients now to hospital who contact 999 for an ambulance response. So
where are they going then, other than that, Nigel?
If we have a patient with a specific problem that can be dealt with by something other than going to sit outside the emergency department, it's a win for the patient if they go to definitive care straight away. And that can be referral to a community service. It can be engaging with palliative care services, district nursing, referring to some of the specialist clinics that some of the hospitals have set up, although sometimes in very differing ways across Northern Ireland, where we can bring people direct to units where they will assess and manage patients, particularly elderly patients with frailty conditions. There are lots of potential alternatives, and probably our most successful is the one we've seen dealing with patients in mental health crisis, where now 40% of the people ringing us in mental health crisis we can manage without actually dispatching an ambulance by engaging mental health professionals in our own control room.
So let's just make that real, a few of those ways real this morning so that we all understand them. So rather than someone going to an A&E that's having a mental health crisis, what happens?
Well, we have a number of different pathways, but the most prominent one is where we now have mental health clinicians working in our control room. And whereas previously our only option was really to bring somebody to hospital for the crisis response team to assess them in an emergency department, often after a lengthy wait, we now have those very same professionals in our control room engaging directly with patients over the phone and referring directly to the follow-up that those patients would have received anyway, albeit after a very, you know, torturous and lengthy delay sitting outside the emergency department.
A follow-up where?
Directly at the mental health clinics, if that's appropriate, or sometimes the situation can be de-escalated by those mental health professionals simply by the counselling and support they offer.
Look, I'm the layperson, you're the professional, but just when I hear that, is that not very impersonal? That there's someone having a mental health crisis to such an extent where they phone 999 and they never see anybody. So rather than being in a hospital setting, rather than interacting with human beings, it's now preferable to talk to them on the phone and give them an appointment.
Well, 2 points there, Stephen, that a lot of these people phone 999 because they have difficulty accessing the alternatives. I think there's still an education piece for the public about the alternatives to phoning 999 and how better to access all the other pieces of care that are out there. But look at it from the other perspective, Stephen. If you are somebody who's in a mental health crisis, you know, is it really the right thing to be sitting in the back of an ambulance for many hours outside an emergency department and then to be brought into a very busy, bustling emergency department where everybody is rushing about and to have to wait there for many hours until you can be assessed?
I don't know, but at least there are people around them. A telephone call surely is much more impersonal than being around people, especially if they've got a mental health crisis, Nigel. They're possibly lonely. They possibly feel isolated. There's maybe nobody around them for days.
Well, as I say, most of these patients, I beg your pardon, 40% of these patients, that's less than the majority, 40% of these can be de-escalated simply over the phone. But the options are there for the mental health workers to refer directly into the very same services and very same clinics directly.
Okay.
So actually we're avoiding the bit in the middle, which is the hanging around outside the emergency department, waiting in the emergency.
Fair enough.
So the patients are actually getting to definitive care more quickly and more effectively. So it's a better deal for the patient.
That's people with mental health. What other tools are you using to send people elsewhere other than ED? What type of instances?
Okay. If we think about patients, particularly older patients who fall at home, this is one of the first pathways we introduced, that we recognise there are people who will fall and they will be injured. And yes, they will need their x-rays and they'll need potentially a hip surgery or whatever in the hospital. But there are a lot of elderly people and frail people who may fall actually aren't injured. But we know that if we were to just bring that person to the hospital, they would be assessed, they'd be sent home. If we were to just leave them at home, there's potentially, in fact, in many cases, an underlying condition which has caused them to fall. That could be a heart irregularity, it could be problems with blood pressure, medication, etc. So rather than just saying to somebody, no, you seem all right now, we'll leave you at home, we refer these patients into fall services where they can get an assessment directly, often in their own home.
How quickly?
Like physios, OTs, from pharmacists even to adjust their medication.
How quickly?
And that usually happens within a couple of days.
Does it?
Yeah. So effectively we're sorting out the underlying problems without having to bring somebody to an emergency department. The aim is to prevent this happening again, because we know a lot of those people, if we don't look after them in this way, they will fall again and potentially it will be more serious the next time.
And how do you know, Nigel, they haven't broken anything if they haven't had that scan at hospital?
Well, with any of these pathways, we have safety criteria, or it's almost like a checklist. And you know, if somebody has fallen and has broken a hip, there will typically be symptoms and signs that will alert you to that. And that will be obviously pain, moving a joint, difficulty weight bearing is always a red flag, which means somebody is likely to need an x-ray. Significant deformity would be an obvious one, you know, significant swelling and bruising over a joint. So there is a threshold of safety here. But if somebody seems to have suffered a simple mechanical fall, And they're uninjured, yes, it is reasonable to leave them at home if we've done a proper assessment on them. But if there's likely to be an underlying reason that we can't easily detect, or it may be related to medication, etc., these are the people with just a little bit of extra thought, a little bit of extra input, we can prevent this becoming a crisis a week, 2 weeks, a month down the line.
But the reason why you need a scan is because often these things can be missed. And is there not, again, a danger in this? And look, Nigel, this is I heard one of your colleagues this morning talk about this as a societal decision to make. But if the pressure then, or the instinct is, do we have to, can we get away with not bringing this person to hospital? How many fractures, how many breakages are we going to, or how many breaks are we going to miss?
Well, the evidence so far, Stephen, is that is very rare. I'll not say it's perfect. We have had a tiny number of incidences in the past where even after an assessment, we have missed something. If we get that wrong, Stephen, I'm desperately sorry, and certainly it's not what our crews or we would want. But I'd say the reason the checklists are there are to provide that sort of safety net to allow our crews to make reasonable decisions. And balanced against this, we do also have to consider the harm, which has been very heavily highlighted in the report, the harm that people are suffering, you know, even waiting outside EDs, the deterioration that happens. And if we can find a smarter way to get people assessed more quickly, we can actually prevent harm.
The Department of Health commissioned experts to undertake a review of emergency medicine. Do you know why it hasn't been published?
No, I don't, Stephen. But I will say that the issues we are facing, you know, are seen right across the UK. Yesterday afternoon, and indeed even today, you know, I'm meeting with colleagues from other ambulance services, and the College of Emergency Medicine and other professional bodies recognise the single biggest risk to our patients being the issue of delayed response in the community. And tracking that back to issues of handovers outside hospitals.
But this is to some people it might stink that there's been a report. It's a UK-wide programme. It aims to improve patient treatment, getting it right first time project.
Yep.
There's a report done, but the date someone is choosing not to publish it. Comprehensive reviews of various services not published. What is it the authorities don't want us all to see?
I don't know, Stephen. Certainly, we engaged with review bodies. We had very open and frank discussions with review bodies. We recognise ourselves changes need to be made. We're already making changes. But I'm a big fan of, you know, candour and transparency in these issues. I think the public will be more behind us if we are open and honest.
Have
about
you seen it
matters.
At Pardon? All? Have you seen any part of it?
Now, just to be clear, Stephen, which report you're talking about, because there are so many different reports looking at so many aspects of what we're...
This is where the Department of Health commissioned experts to undertake a review of emergency medicine.
Mm-hmm. And this is the GERFT report, would
Correct.
That be right?
Yes.
Okay. I have seen bits of it, Stephen, and I say we engaged, obviously, from an ambulance service perspective, very openly and very honestly with
Sure.
them.
Sure. It's not for you to release, and yeah, I'm not suggesting yeah. it is, but I guess the point I'm making within this is it has been seen by various members of the medical profession, but for some reason, they're not making it public. Look, what that report also highlighted was issues with patients attending EDs at hospital, which don't have the required services. Mm-hmm. And it said, for example, there is no on-site trauma and orthopaedic service in Antrimaria Hospital. And patients with fractured hips, therefore, often wait days in ED corridors in Antrim before being transferred to the Royal Victoria. So why were we taking people to Antrim if we knew that they couldn't be treated there?
Well, the it's back to what we talked about earlier about checklists, Stephen. When we are out in the community with a patient who has, the commonest example, an elderly person who has fallen and is complaining of a sore hip, we can probably say that somebody is okay if they have none of the signs of you know, a fracture. If they are sore and unable to weight bear, there's the potential for them to have the fracture. But it's going to need an X-ray, realistically, to give a definitive answer. Now, if we take every patient who has fallen and simply has a sore hip to say, for example, the Royal is the nearest alternative to Antrim that does fractures, then that will significantly add to the workload at the Royal Victoria Hospital while giving a bit of relief to Antrim, certainly. But you know, a significant number of those patients, although they are sore, will not have a fracture. So there needs to be some sort of process of discrimination, an initial assessment, which usually involves a straightforward X-ray for a hip fracture.
But some of them have had fractures.
Pardon?
Some of them will have had fractures. I guess, again, the point I'm making is the Northern Ireland Ambulance Service is bringing people to Antrim Area Hospital knowing that they cannot be treated there if they're among the catchment of people who have a fracture.
Now, to be fair, Stephen, if there is an obvious fracture, we will bypass Antrim.
What if it's a maybe?
If it's a maybe, then we can't tell. It's not easy to tell, and I've been caught out by myself even in hospital with assessing patients. You know, it can be difficult, short of an X-ray, to tell whether.
I understand that. So if you're sure, I understand. But if you're not sure, why are some of those people being brought to Antrim?
For the initial X-ray.
Yeah.
So that if we were to take all these patients down to the Royal, that means our Antrim ambulances will end up joining the back of a growing queue outside the Royal Victoria Hospital. Whereas if we bring them to Antrim and hopefully offload them in a timely fashion, those ambulances are available to respond to the next emergency in the community. While if there is a need for subsequent transfer of a patient from the Antrim Hospital to the Royal, that's often done in the non-emergency vehicle. So it's freeing up our emergency resources. But it's the initial sort of diagnostic test that really is going to decide that patient's care is the X-ray that happens in the emergency.
But if we take that elderly person, Nigel, and look, one of your team isn't sure.
Yeah.
They are bringing that elderly, frail person in pain to a hospital where they know that if it is then a fracture, that person will likely be sitting in a corridor for days.
And so when we bring somebody there, the issue of them waiting in the corridor for days, we recognise that is poor care for the patient. Typically, these patients will be operated on within about 48 hours of having their admission to hospital, no matter where they go. But certainly in terms of treating them, Stephen, and leaving somebody in pain, we do treat patients as best we can. We administer pain relief, etc. The ambulances carry significant amounts of pain relief to these patients. But we do recognise that when we arrive at the hospital, no matter where that is, things seem to slow down and everybody is suffering the ill effects of that. But say, bringing somebody to Antrim Hospital is really to determine, are they one of the patients who has a genuine hip fracture and therefore needs transferred to a specialist unit? Or if not, then there's somebody who's going to be discharged back out into the community and hopefully get the care there that they require.
Of course, the same report, the GERF report, recommended that each hospital with major EDs should have an adequate range of medical specialities.
Well, that would be a wider commissioning issue, Stephen, for our colleagues in the Department of Health and SPPG in terms of what services are available in what hospitals. And we know there's a lot of work going on, particularly the NIT, to consider how we reconfigure the wider system. And that is going to require a lot of change of mindsets, both in the health service and in the public, where there probably needs to be wider recognition that sometimes in order to get the best treatment, you may have to travel further to get that.
Why is there so much sickness within the Northern Ireland Ambulance Service?
Stephen, I'm not at all surprised, given what our crews are facing. First of all, it is a very physical job. There's a lot of lifting and carrying patients. It involves long hours. And as the report highlights, over these past few years, we frequently see crews responding to emergencies, doing their absolute best for patients, bringing them to the hospital, and then sitting for many hours outside hospital, trying their best to care for a patient, not being able to deliver the best of care, frequently running past the end of their normal shift time. So impacting very, very much on work-life balance, etc., family life, etc. It is a stressful job at the best of time, and the pressures that our staff are facing, both out on the road And also particularly in our control room, where they are, you know, have this sort of moral distress of, you know, wanting to do the best for patients but being unable to do so. You know, I'm really not surprised that it is impacting heavily on our staff.
The report, one of the recommendations, recommendation four from the report, says it is crucial that recent work done by the ambulance service to reduce its sickness absence rate is sustained. So what have you been doing?
Well, we've been putting a lot more effort into trying to make sure that crews finish on time, for example. That is a big thing that is highlighted by our staff and our staff side representatives frequently. And this is where you see bits in the report about using private ambulance services to support the ongoing, you know, monitoring of patients outside hospital to try and let our staff away on time. And we've taken some very difficult decisions that shift change over time, that we may send a proportion of our ambulances to hospital to take over the care of patients from colleagues who have been waiting there for several hours.
Taking ambulances off the roads to go and sit at a hospital.
It is, yep, and that is a really, really difficult choice, Stephen, you know, because the alternative to that, and it sounds counterintuitive when there are already emergency calls waiting, and let me stress that the critical emergency calls will get the immediate ambulance response. But if we don't do that, Stephen, we have staff who run many hours past the end of their shift. They're quite rightly entitled to something called compensatory arrest, which is mentioned in the report. And the effect of that is that when that crew who finish a shift at 8 o'clock this morning are due to come on for their next shift, they actually may not, you know, be expected to turn in for an extra couple of hours by way of sort of compensation time for what they have done. And that further impacts
it's
on our ability
to respond. It's all a mess, isn't it?
It's frustrating, Stephen. And say, despite how hard everybody is working to try and address it, you know, we all feel the pain of what we're trying to do, but we recognise the potential harm that this is causing to patients, and that is where a lot of the distress and frustration lies.
And can I just ask finally, those ambulances you're taking off the grid to go and sit at a hospital to take over from another ambulance which has been off the grid, is that leading to you not being able to attend critical incidents?
Well, I think this is the crux of the whole report, Stephen. And you know, the biggest highlight of the report was into the effect of delayed response as a result of the handovers. That if our ambulances are sitting outside an emergency department, a very busy emergency department, then and they're doing that in large numbers, it significantly impacts on our response to get to the next emergency. And that's reflected in our response times. It is the equivalent every day of 25% of our workforce effectively not being able to do work. And I don't think you see that anywhere else in the health service or in the public sector or even the private sector, where 25% of one's workforce are simply not able to do anything because they're sitting stationary and monitoring people outside.
And how many staff do you have off at any time?
We monitor that.
Has it got a lot worse?
No, it's improved significantly, Stephen. The report did give some figures, I think, up until the end of the 23-24 year. I think there were figures quoted of up to 14%. We've been doing a lot of work over this in the past few years, and we're down to around 10%. But even that is still too high, Stephen. And these people are not chancers. You know, they're not swinging the lead by any means. These are people who are working really hard, okay, and they're stressed. And we're doing our best to support them. And we're seeing some improvement with that, but we've better to do.
Dr. Nigel Ruddle, thank you for spending so much time with us this morning. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, 0330 80 55 55. We're looking for your experiences of waiting for an ambulance, how timely they've come or not. 0330 80 55 55. 9:33, news time now from the BBC. Right, good morning to you all. Robert in Belfast. Morning, Robert.
Good morning, Stephen. Nice to talk to you again,
Stephen. It's an interesting situation, Robert, with the ambulance service, isn't it?
Yes, Stephen. There's been multiple occasions when taxi drivers right across the province, people now have caught on now when they can't get an ambulance. They're using taxi drivers as transport to get them to the A&E. I've experienced it myself. A lot of months ago, I was coming down the Antrim Road, and a person come out of a street and flagged me down to take her mother to the A&E in the Royal. And there's many occasions when incidents happen in around the city centre to come to the taxi ranks and to get the drivers to take them to A&E. Also, private hire taxi drivers. The people phone up now when they can't be prepared to wait on an ambulance. They phone up and taxi drivers go to their home addresses and take them to A&E.
Robert, thank you. The DP's Dan Dodds. Morning, Dan.
Good morning.
Well, look, we're hearing the extent of the problem. It's an acute problem. It's an horrendous situation for people who are sitting waiting on an ambulance and their loved ones. But the question is, what do we do about it? We've been told this morning yet again what the problem is. What do we do about it?
Well, first of all, Stephen, can I say I spent some time in January in A&E in Craigavon, and there were some patients waiting in ambulances. And the senior consultant there was saying, you know, patients are vulnerable. They're generally very ill. Some are very elderly and confused. It's very difficult to keep patients even warm in an ambulance. And while they are getting basic care, their outcomes would be so much better if they were into A&E and onto a ward as quickly as possible. And I think that that is the where we need to get to. And remember that this is always about patients. In terms of what do we do about the problem? Well, the problem is generally caused by the fact that we haven't addressed the issue of patient flow in hospitals. The transfer from the Northern Ireland Ambulance Service to the Accident and Emergency Department onto the ward and, very importantly, out of the hospital again. And what we're actually doing in Northern Ireland, we're keeping sick patients in ambulances who can't get into hospital because hundreds of well patients can't get out of hospital. Now, there's a real lack of strategic thinking in that. It's almost the theatre of the absurd.
We know all of that, Dan, and you've reminded us about it this morning, which is why I'm trying to focus the question on, okay, we've heard this before, we know about this, so what are we going to do about it? What is the strategic thinking? What's your party proposing?
We need to manage the flow of patients much, much better in hospitals. That will come down, and everything comes down to this, of enabling patients who are well and able to go home from hospital to have and who need appropriate care at home. So it will come down to actually reforming and expanding social care in the community, making more nursing home beds available, making more care packages available, making sure that our social care workers are properly paid and treated so that it becomes an attractive job to do. This is important work.
And
people are not being paid well enough.
And this is where, Dan Dodds, there was an opportunity for your party and others to spell this out in a programme for government, to commit a definite amount of money in a programme for government, and your party, one of the key signatories, did not do that. So the £215 million that was not committed to in the programme for government is a, we hope to be able to provide somewhere between zero and £215 million. Your party was one of the signatories to that document that did not guarantee money to the Department of Health. And guess what? There was John Boucher right up behind them days later saying, by the way, you haven't committed money to policing yet either. So this spells out for us the lack of a government sitting down and working out definitely how collectively you're going to prioritise things.
Right. So there are a number of things to unpack in relation to that. So in relation to health, Stephen, it's really important to remember that the priority that is in the programme for government is the issue of waiting lists. And when I get
letter... There are nine priorities. It's just not. There were nine health priorities and they did not prioritise health.
On this occasion, we'll talk about health, Stephen, because that is really important to people in their everyday life. And that's what this report is about how we get sick people into hospital and well people out of hospital. And that's really important to remember that. Now, I am pleased that there is a priority around waiting lists. But waiting lists won't just be reduced by throwing money at the waiting list. Money's important. It's massively important. But we have also got to get enough staff to make sure that we have extra capacity within the service to actually reduce those waiting lists. And that is one of the issues that we have in the Department of Health, is producing that really good workforce strategy that will allow us to go forward. I do hope that when we reach maybe next year, that there, we will see the end of one-year budgets and that these will
But again, Dan, your party, Sinn Féin, the other parties in that executive, had a choice. Difficult choices to make, yes. Whether to create a recurring budget for the health service or indeed the PSNI or anyone else. You chose not to give the health... It was a choice. And you chose not, your party chose not to give the health service a recurring budget. So how on earth does Mike Nesbitt recruit?
Well, Stephen, I think that we need to, the commitment on waiting lists in the programme for government is actually for the time of the whole of the programme for government until the end of the mandate.
And it's anywhere so between zero extra money and 215 million. How do you recruit on that?
So I know that the minister will be actually working on that issue. Now, what we need to see from the minister, we've got a commitment to reduce waiting list. We've got a commitment on funding to reduce waiting list. What we need to see from the minister is a plan to reduce waiting list. Now, we have an elective care plan, and the minister talks a lot about elective care centres and how those will reduce waiting lists. So far, those elective care centres operate Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, but not all the time, 9 to 5, and they only eat at the edges of the waiting lists. And what we're hearing from people across Northern Ireland, I had a letter the other day from the chief executive of the Western Trust, who told me that the average time for a routine hip replacement, so no complications, just routine hip replacements in the Western Trust area, was 9 years. That is just unbelievable. And so therefore, there is an important and strategic priority in reducing waiting lists, taking people out of pain and making sure that those who have cancer and need red flags referrals can be seen very, very quickly. I'm glad that priority is there. It's important. But it's also important in addressing ambulance waiting times that we actually get to manage the flow of patients in hospital and that we get some strategic thinking around that. And we'll only be able to do that if we actually get to grips with the crisis in social care. More care home beds, more care in the community, better support for families, and things like the hospital at home service where people are actually kept out of hospital and their conditions managed by clinicians in their own home.
And finally, Diane, we know that the Health Minister wrote to Emma Little-Pengelly, the Deputy First Minister, and Michelle O'Neill, our First Minister, last week, seeking assurance and clarity on the 215 speculated figure. Has Mike Nesbitt got a response yet? Do you know? Should he have had?
Well, of course, you'll have to talk to Mike Nesbitt or the First and Deputy First Minister. And I know that Emma did step up and you had a very long interview with Emma around issues for the programme for government. We want to make progress. But we will only make progress when we work as a whole. The health service is a very complex sort of being, and we cannot lift out one thing without addressing another. So ambulance handover times can't be addressed unless we get better flow of patients in hospital. Waiting times and waiting lists can't be addressed unless we have money and staff and capacity in the system to address them. And I've actually been saying to the Health Minister for quite a long time, he needs to tell us in a comprehensive way how he's going to do that.
Dan Dodds from the DUP, thank you. The Alliance MLA, Danny Donnelly, with us this morning. Good morning to you, Danny.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. And by the way, we will go to the Executive Office right now. That's who represents the First and Deputy First Minister, their office. We will ask them if Mike Nesbitt has had a response to the questions he was asking around when is he getting the £215 million figure. And Mr Nesbitt knows that 215 is not guaranteed. But he's asked them. So let's see what the executive office tell us. Danny Donnelly, your party was yet another party, along with the DUP, who signed off that programme for government for those people who think, oh, was that important or not? Well, here we're talking about delayed ambulance times, and we don't have a commitment of extra money to fix them, do we?
And there are many, many crises ongoing all at the same time within the health service, Stephen, and this is just one of them. And the report itself is stark, and it confirms what we've been hearing for months from constituents, and this will not be a surprise to people across Northern Ireland. People have been waiting in ambulances for long, long periods outside any departments that are completely full, wards that are completely full with corridor beds up and down. Our whole health system is clogged. Patient flow is compromised. We have hundreds of patients who are medically fit to be discharged and can't be because there's no capacity in the community. We know what the solutions are. We have to address
them. What are they?
It is about community. It's about moving into the community, expanding domiciliary care, expanding acute care at home services, looking at other pathways for patients who don't need to be brought into
hospital.
Where
are we getting the money from? To expand the... Look, we can go round and round circles, and I'm not saying this cheekily, Danny. Most weeks we spell out the problems with the health service. The question is, how are we going to get to a point where we fix it? So you've talked about expanding domiciliary care. That needs investment. Your party signed off a programme for government which did not have a guarantee of extra money for the health service. So where are we getting that extra money to expand domiciliary care as an example?
The health service is a priority for the executive. The health service gets 52% of the budget for the entire Northern Ireland Assembly, for all the departments. It clearly is the priority. We know our health service does need to reform. We've known that for years. The Bangor report was 2016. We need to reform in line with the Bangor principles in order to make it more efficient, in order to make it perform better. So we know we're way, way behind on that. We could have been 9 years into a reform package had the Assembly stayed up. You know, that shows you the causes of this. If we don't reform our institutions, things like this will happen. But we do need to reform our health service. We need to expand into the community. We need to have acute care at home services built up. The Southern Trust has a fantastic service at the minute, but that is not the same across the whole of Northern Ireland. We need to expand that. We need to look at other pathways.
Sorry, hold on. So acute care at home means more people on the ground, those men and women who travel throughout Northern Ireland, providing care packages to people so that they can stay at home. Again, that costs money. That also requires us to treat some of those people who are leaving the profession because they're so lowly paid better, doesn't it?
Acute care at home is a specific service offered, particularly in the Southern Trust, although no other trusts are looking at it, where medical professionals manage patients who would otherwise be managed in the hospital, but manage them in their own homes. So they're able to treat them at home so they don't need to go to hospital. Keeping people out of hospital when they don't need to be
is
there.
Is that doctors travelling to people? Or who is
there
that?
There are medical professionals and nurses.
And that's in the Southern Trust area, Danny, is
in
it?
The Southern Trust area. The Health Committee visited it a couple of weeks ago, and it appears to be a fantastic service that has reduced the impact on its local health.
Why has the Southern Trust been... Are they trialling it on behalf of the others, or why is there only one trust doing that in Northern Ireland?
Trusts do things differently right across Northern Ireland. Certainly that's something we've found within the Health Committee. There are many, many differences between trusts. And I think certainly, you know, we should be looking at best practice and we should be applying that right across Northern Ireland.
Okay.
This particular scheme does seem to help to impact the impact on our hospitals. Keeping people at home and treating them at home when they don't need to be in hospital is the right and certainly part of the solution.
We'll contact the Southern Trust and see if we can get a representative to come on. It'll not be today, but any day this week, to explain to us how that's going, because it sounds innovative. Danny, thank you. Thank you very much. Martin Macrofelt. Morning, Martin.
Morning, Stephen.
Go ahead, sir. Thanks for calling.
Stephen, why do we never hear on your programme or the TV or media anywhere from the heads of these trusts? They seem to be in the darkness. they never come out and tell us what they're doing. If you're the leader or running or paid to run an organisation, be it private or public, surely you have a duty to answer to the people who are employing you what's happening. The head of this organisation. I mean, you keep interviewing doctors and they're pushed out to the front and explaining everything. Where's the boss at? Why are they not talking?
Well, we
paid huge salaries.
Well, so that you know, we asked every one of the trusts this morning if they would talk to any of you. We actually asked them to put up a spokesperson. These trusts are full of thousands of people. Not one.
There's only one boss, Stephen. There's only one boss.
Not one
why
trust.
Why is Mike Nesbitt not forcing those people, right, go you out in front of the people who employ you and explain to them what you are doing?
Well, not one of the trusts, not one of the bosses would make themselves available to any of you this morning. They all sent in statements.
That has become a very common thing now, Stephen. I mean, very few of our elected representatives are in your program anymore. Because
that's actually not true.
The head of them. Well, the head of them. I go back to the boss, Stephen. The boss is the boss all the time. You know, why is Michelle O'Neill not on there this morning? Or Emma Little Pengelly? Why are they not talking to you about what's going on?
Emma Little Pengelly is in America and did an interview with the Nolan team last week. So is Michelle.
Well, is mine not a fair question? If you employ somebody and give them a huge salary to run an organisation, should that person not be able to face the public who employ them and tell them what they are doing?
Martin, thank you very much, sir. Colin McGrath from the SLP. Good morning to you, Colin.
Good morning, Stephen.
So look, an opposition isn't just there to criticise and hold to account, although that is one of the functions. You should have an idea how to fix things. How do we fix this?
Yes. I mean, criticise and hold account is one of the most important parts of a democracy and one that's often been lacking here. Somebody that's prepared to ask the difficult questions of ministers and hold the transparency and accountability to them. And I think we need to see that, because if we look just over the last week, Stephen, as you've recounted on the shows and I've discussed with you, we have executive ministers who didn't know what was in the programme for government, so had to take a break before it was actually then passed. Then we have executive ministers who are committing funds to another department before they even know that they have that funding. And even today, we have two representatives of the executive on telling us how bad the whole system is. So I think it's important to highlight there that there is a collective responsibility from this executive about dealing with the issues. And I feel that we've kind of missed the issue of the ambulances really this morning. And talking about other things. And the line that the auditor in her press release has said that the department itself has commissioned research which cited ambulance handover delays as the single biggest risk to patients in the emergency care system. But we don't have any suggestions on how to fix that. And with frustration about that, we've decided in the SDLP to take it upon ourselves. We've went to London. We visited the ambulance service there. We visited emergency departments in London because they faced this problem before. And there's no point in reinventing a wheel. If somebody has faced a problem and they have delivered a solution, and then we went over to see that solution and see if there were parts of that that could be introduced here. That's why we've published our Help Can't Wait document, where we're suggesting that we follow the London ambulance system of W45, whereby if after 45 minutes the handover hasn't taken place, there is a space that is set aside that the patient is sent to. There can be cohorting of the paramedics. In other words, if you have 5-6 ambulances sitting outside, that you bring the patients together and just leave some of the ambulance staff to look after them, allowing 3 or 4 of the ambulances to get back on the road.
Well, helping ambulances get back on the road. But you're just grouping together patients in that scenario to sit and wait. And what if a number of them get critically ill while they're waiting, and the paramedics, the ambulance staff, they've left then, right?
So again, this is about choices to try and fix part of the system till we get the overall fix, and it's not the ideal. The ideal should be that an ambulance should come up and put you straight into the emergency department. But if that's not happening, then you have to do something. And if there is a space that is close to the emergency department that patients can go into, if they're going to get critically ill but be 20 or 30 metres away from the emergency department, then they can be immediately seen.
Colin, has your party... Have you an understanding? You say you've visited the model in England. Have you an understanding why there is such a contrast, that 37% of handovers from people in an ambulance to hospital are done within a 15-minute target in England and only 7% here in Northern Ireland. What is different about here?
Well, I think that speaks to what the conversation that you had with earlier reps about the systemic problems that we need to be able to fix the problems of patient flow. But I think the problem
the question is why is it different?
But because of the patient flow, we've got patient flow wrong over a number of years, and as a result, it has become a very big problem. I have no doubt that not having a health minister for 5 out of the last 8 years meant that there has been a drift in terms of decision-making about the direction of funds that could try. I mean, if you were identifying a problem 10 years ago with domiciliary care and you wanted to do something about it, but it required new qualifications, it required new programmes, it needed new recruitment, if in 5 of the last 8 years we didn't have an executive, that is going to cause problems.
Okay.
So we have those backups. There are many other things that need, but this is not a simple thing, but we can't overlook the major problem, because the next 999 call, Stephen, could be your mother or my mother in a serious situation. If we're told there's no ambulance available, I can tell you the next day, neither you nor I will be a happy camper.
Colin, thank you, sir. Thank you. Good morning to you. Anya McGee from Carers NI. Good morning, Anya.
Good morning.
And if the whole push is more people at home, that's a lot more pressure on carers.
Well, yeah, I think for me, the findings in this ambulance handover report from the audit office today are really shocking. I think they really should serve as a wake-up call for us all, because this report talks about harm and potential harm to patients. The GIRT report that was accessed by the Northern Ireland Audit Office as part of this report also discussed the possibilities and the significant opportunity for harm to patients while they wait in corridors. No, it's referenced within the Northern Ireland, this report. It indicates that the auditor accessed that report. It indicated that the Department of Health has not responded to that report, nor has it published its findings. But Stephen, what I will say is that this report shines a light on harm to patients and potential harm to patients, harm especially for those who are caring for people, because as a carer, you are standing alongside helpless while that person waits 6, 8, 10, 36 hours, either in the back of an ambulance or either in crammed in like sardines into ED and major wards. And then this report also flags to me the harm to staff who are trying their very, very best every single day to do a good job against impossible circumstances. So from a carer's NI point of view, I think it's important that everyone takes a step back to understand there are four legs to the health service. One is secondary care, the second is primary care, the third is social care, and the fourth is the community and voluntary sector. And all of those have to be integrated. All of those have to be resourced, or else nothing works. And we are finding that more and more, that underinvestment in social care has led to all of these pressures building up at the front door of the hospitals and on our ambulance crews and ED staff.
Okay, Anya, thank you very much indeed. Good morning to you. So as we look at the situation with our health service, this report out today, drawing attention to the terrible handover times within the ambulance service, the questions remain as they were. How are we going to pay? How are we going to pay for this health service? Can Mike Nesbitt, the health minister, should he take responsibility? What can he do within the pot of money he has to fix or alleviate some of these problems? And where does the health service sit as a priority against policing, against education? Big, big questions for us all to answer together. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us today at 10:04. It's the Nolan Show from the BBC. I see Manchester United have announced plans for a new 100,000 seat stadium. So that'll be good news for those of you who are Man United fans. It's meant to cost, £1.5 billion, this new stadium? Not be costing me anything. I got rid of my season ticket because they were complete bores when you were watching them. Anyway, so after one of the biggest storms that Northern Ireland's seen in years, no route to compensation, though, then, for those hit by Storm Owen. In total, 285,000 households and businesses were impacted by electricity cuts, with some areas getting winds of 95 miles per hour back in January. In the days following the storm, both the First and Deputy First Ministers called on NIE to consider issuing a goodwill compensation to those heavily impacted by power cuts.
We understand that that is what's happening with Scottish companies, energy companies in Scotland in relation to the same storm. We see no reason why this shouldn't happen here. So we are urging NIE to go away, consider that and come back to us very quickly with an indication of what they want to do, because we know that those people who are without electricity and water are suffering real hardship. Many of them have had to go out, eat out. They're not able to make food for their family within their homes.
In terms of the people that need support, I mean, we made the case very strongly to NIE this morning again that we believe that there should be a goodwill payment, because some people have had to buy food out all weekend. That's not acceptable. We're coming towards the end of January. People could be struggling to get towards the end of the month. And certainly, as I said, the lady I was speaking to with three children having to buy food out, hot food from supermarkets, etc., all weekend, that's not sustainable.
Well, not sustainable, says Michelle O'Neill. There you heard Emma Little-Pengelly also talk about the need for compensation. The bottom line is, it's not happening. The Department for Economy have said that there are no existing routes to compensation. The former Sinn Féin MP for Mid-Ulster, Francie Molloy. You were out of power for quite a while, Francie, weren't you? Good morning.
Yes. Good morning, Stephen. Yes, I was out for almost 8 days. And whenever they come to fix it, eventually it took 4 hours to fix it. That could have been done at the beginning of the week. But there is need for compensation.
It's not happening, Francie. It's not happening.
Well, the shareholders in both ESB and NIE are the people who actually should be compensating. And it's a very simple way of actually doing it. It doesn't need any great legislation to do it, because they take the money off people so they can actually return it to people. They can make sure that people actually are compensated for it in that way. So it is important, and it's important to remember that ESB owned the power lines. They were sold the power lines by, I think it was Arlene Foster as a minister, back some years ago from the Assembly. So the legislation should have been put in place to protect the customers, to ensure that customers got compensated if a utility like ESB or NIE didn't provide the proper service, and they didn't provide the proper service.
The utility regulator, Francie, was telling us when they were on, I can't remember his name now, but he was sitting in the studio beside me when Storm Éowyn was happening. And they were telling us that, look, careful what you wish for, essentially, because compensation, if it's paid by NIE, it'll be added on to everyone's bill in Northern Ireland. So everyone would pay for the compensation that some would eventually get. And clearly the decision's been made not to do that.
Yes, and I think the Assembly should have stepped in there. Like the First and Deputy First Minister said that there should be a goodwill payment from NIE, and that's proper and correct. But it needs to be enforced. And the legislation, whatever legislation is required, should have been introduced right away. Because that's one of the benefits of a local assembly, about devolved administration, is that you can make local decisions for local situations, and there should have been legislation brought in immediately, emergency legislation, to ensure that compensation could be paid from the NIE and from the ESB as regards the power line. I don't know what the situation is in the south, but ESB, I understand, were compensating people in the south, so the same legislation should apply here.
Oh, they were getting compensation in Scotland as well.
Yes, getting compensation everywhere. But for actually say that we should actually have to pay for our own compensation is actually ludicrous. You know, whenever the shareholders get their dividend, they don't share that out with the rest of us. So they're a multi-million pound investment. Why should they not actually then compensate their customers? Now, each customer is equal within that and should be compensated. You have people working from home who could no longer work from home because they didn't have supply, they didn't have internet, all the rest of it. And so those people were out of work and out of money. And the same thing with people who actually were trying to cook for their family at home. They actually had to go out and eat or out and buy in and nothing to heat it on, nothing to cook it on. Even those with room heaters and small things had no electricity for to drive the central heating system. So everyone was actually sitting in cold homes, no light, no electricity and no power.
Malachy Quinn from the SCLP listening to this morning. Look, Malachy, it was John French, that's who the regular was, who was in the studio with me. And it changed the narrative slightly when he reminded people, Malachy, everyone would have to pay for this compo. And now it hasn't happened.
It did change the mindset of some, perhaps, Stephen. But we'll have to remember the reason that Scotland is getting payments is because they passed legislation that wasn't passed here in Northern Ireland. And Francie's right, people down south are being compensated as well. But we need to remind people, this is not just a case of people who lost electricity for a few hours. I myself lost my electricity for, I think, an hour and a half. No problem to me. I have constituents that were out of power for a week and a half, in a home with complex medical needs, where they had to go out and get help. They couldn't even boil a kettle in their house. They had to go out and buy food. They had to do a lot of things that they wouldn't have had to. NIE knew what the fault was on their line, but still they didn't fix it for a week and a half, despite everybody else on the road being reconnected. There are very considerate families that have been hard hit over the storm that are not being compensated. Now, in any other walk of life, Stephen, any other walk of life, for example, if O2 lose a signal for a couple of days, they compensate the people on the O2 line. If BT Internet is not meeting the standards, they compensate their customers as well. It isn't out of the realms of possibility that NIE can compensate people that have been out of electricity for not just one day, but for a week and a half. And I think it's absolutely ridiculous that they are turning around and telling us, no, we're not doing it. I remember that the Economy Minister also said there was an agreement in principle a couple of weeks ago. So I would love to know what's happened between then and now to come out and say, no, we're not paying people. And I just think it's completely unacceptable.
Well, NIE have said in a statement that they have worked with the Department for Economy and the utility regulator to assess the viability of the creation of a severe weather compensation scheme. They then say NIE Networks will continue to work with all parties to ensure it delivers any and all requirements that's set out in the legislation. In other words, they pivot that, don't they? So there they are in the first sentence saying that, look, we've worked with the Department of Economy to consider this. And then in the second sentence, they're essentially saying we're not legally required to give it. They say, as a regulated company, the earnings and expenditure of NIE Networks are set out in a publicly consulted on regulated price control process. NIE Networks is legally required to work within this process. So they don't actually say within the statement, we're not giving compo and here's why. They don't actually address that issue at all, despite the fact that they know that's what we're talking about. Why do these people write these statements like they do? Why don't NIE just come out and say, if we were to pay this, it would be added on to everyone's bill, or it would affect our profits and we're not doing it. You get this convoluted malarkey from them. The utility regulator, the former Minister for the Economy, requested that the utility regulator work with his officials and NIE Networks as part of a working group to consider how compensatory payments for Storm Éowyn could be made, specifically in terms of how they could be recovered through NIE Networks grid charges, which subsequently form part of customer bills. That's the bit we've been telling you about. You end up paying for it, all of you. The utility regulator goes on, as the utility regulator for Northern Ireland, we set guaranteed standards of service, which are the minimum levels of service customers should expect from NIE Networks in normal weather conditions. Customers can apply for compensation if NIE Networks do not meet the minimum levels of service under the GSS. The working group recognised that the GSS legislation allows NIE Networks to apply an exemption in the event of severe weather. NIE Networks have confirmed that they are satisfied that this exemption applies to Storm Éowyn. Any other options considered by the working group would require legal Éowyn. I can't pronounce it. You know what it is, Stormy. Goodness sake. Any of the other options considered by the working group would require legal or regulatory modifications which cannot be applied retrospectively for Storm E. The utility regulator will continue to engage with the Department for the Economy and NIE Networks in respect of any future steps. So in other words, you're not getting it.
Yeah, and we wonder what the regulator's job is. A regulator is supposed to speak up on behalf of the customers and to work with the customers. The Minister for the Economy is actually, again, supposed to speak up for the customers. But unfortunately, nobody seems to be speaking up for the customers who actually have been left stranded. And the NIE and ESB weren't prepared for this storm. They had plenty of notification about it, but they weren't prepared. Are they still prepared for another storm? Or what regulation or what legislation is being brought in now to ensure this doesn't happen again if we can't do anything about the present.
Okay, Francie, thank you. Maliki, thank you. 0330 80 55 55. Let's come back to health, the delay in the ambulances. Sid, good morning, Sid.
Good morning.
Good morning. You're 55, Sid, and you had a bleed in the brain 5 years ago after work.
No, 2 years ago.
Two years ago.
Second of the first 23.
Okay. What were the symptoms? What happened?
Well, I came in from work around 9 o'clock, and I knew something wasn't right, and speech started to go and stuff like that there. I rang the girl that I was going with, Kathy, you call her, and I says, look, I think I'm taking a stroke. I need to up to the hospital. She rang the ambulance service, so they did, and they weren't able to give her time for the ambulance to come or stuff like that there. So Kathy came down. I can't really remember much about it, but she got me to hospital. And then the ambulance rang at 3 a.m, saying they couldn't get into the house looking to get in. But that was 5 hours later.
And the messaging to us from, you know, we've had this drilled into us, the Department of Health messaging, the ads, you know, act fast if you think you've got a stroke. And if you act fast, that can really determine.
Save you, And I would say if it wasn't for Kathy, I wouldn't be here today. Because she came into the house and she got me out of that house. And how she managed to do it, I don't know. So it is, I can't really remember much about it or the journey to the hospital. I can remember arriving at the hospital and the people in the hospital were brilliant. They done their best. So they did. And they wheeled me in the wheelchair and stuff like that. And seemed to me really quick.
So here you are then, knowing that your ambulance appeared 5 hours despite...
Yeah, five.
Despite,
5 hours, actually.
Despite them being told the symptoms were that of a stroke.
Yeah.
It's really worrying, isn't it?
It actually is, because, you know, how many people out there haven't been as lucky as I am, you know, where the ambulance didn't get to them.
Sid, thank you. And Peter and Carrickfergus. Morning, Peter.
Well, Stephen, I think that the whole problem starts from your doctor, because whenever you phone your doctor, it's go up to hospital. And I was up and I sat in the hospital for 46 hours.
Oh, come on. Did you?
Yes. Yes. 46 hours. And I could give you a gate and prove it. And I had what I didn't know. I didn't want to go to... I'm sitting here with a broken rib and I won't go to hospital because there's no way I'm going up there to sit 48 hours, 50 hours to get treated. So I'm quite happy looking at Dr. Google and he tells me take rest. But anyway, when I did get up into hospital, we're sitting... And a lot of people, Stephen, the patients...
How did you bust your ribs? And you shouldn't be using Google, by the way. You should ask your doctor. But how did you bust your ribs?
I just tripped over. I made a think of thought there was a mini ace thing and earthquake and Carrick, hadn't it? You know, and it just fell over a footpath. But sure, that's the way it goes. But because of my last experience, I don't want to be there. But saying that, Stephen, when I got up into the ward, I couldn't have got any better treatment than you could ask for. Really, all right, I'm stuck in the corner. But they were brilliant. So I'm not going to knock on nurses. The problem is from the phone call to the doctor, go up in the accident emergency. There's too many people in the accident emergency that shouldn't be there. And you're going to laugh at this, but the patients was there when they were sending sandwiches around. That didn't even reach us because the people in the hospital waiting room eat them before they got their patients. That's how bad the hospital is at the minute. You know?
It's like a war zone some nights, isn't it?
Yes, but you can go into X emergency with a sore foot, and there's that many headers running about it. Sorry the word for headers. But that many people there, you could end up coming out stabbed or beat up or anything. You know, I'm big enough to look after myself, but I have seen it. And I've been in the ward, Stephen, where they have said, and this is honest to God truth, they've said to people, right, they can get you home tomorrow. Oh, I can't go home tomorrow. Because they've got the painters in and they won't be finished to 2 days.
Come on.
Stephen, I'm deadly
serious. You've got to be making that up. And there's nobody being stabbed in NEs, by the way.
No, but I'm not making it up. People, you know, you have to understand as well, Stephen, things are tight when they are in the flu. You have to remember the old people. That might be the only time when they're in hospital they get food at a regular basis. They're in heat. You know, that's not their excuse, but it can happen. You know what I mean?
Peter, thank you. Helen, morning, Helen.
How you doing, Stephen?
Morning.
That's right.
Okay.
I'm ringing you. I've had four experiences actually in the last 12 months or 13 months of family members needing emergency ambulances. I'm from Fermanagh, so obviously those are to Derry. But the one I was deciding to talk on based on what I heard Nigel Ruddle speak about earlier was my father was on a post-operative admission to Altney Galvin from SWA last January. A consultant ordered a blue light ambulance at 4:30 in the afternoon. At 9 p.m. he got a private ambulance with no paramedic cover. He travelled from Enniskillen to Derry for 2 hours. There was a delayed handover which lasted approximately 3 hours, and during that time, when we're on the corridor with these people who we actually didn't know at the time weren't paramedics, a doctor came out and did an incredibly personal and an undignified experience. He had to have a high rectal examination done in a storeroom in Altney Galvin while he was still under the care of a private ambulance company, and a driver had to hold the door in front of him to make sure no one came in. It is shocking what we're going through with ambulances. And as of 2 weeks ago, my son had an appendicectomy. He had again to have an ambulance called from SWA. He was an emergency transfer. The ambulance that came to collect him was not an emergency ambulance. It had neither of the crew had any paramedic training. And again, we had to travel behind it, hoping in good faith he'd be okay getting there. And we're sitting, and you're actually getting a phone call from Altney Galvin as a patient this morning. My father is in hospital, having had a GI bleed, which is traumatic and frightening and terrifying. And to see him put in an ambulance and to go up behind it for hours with no one at the crew at that stage were paramedics, could not have done better. The frontline staff in both hospitals could not have done better. But some of these managers need to be held accountable for the extreme risk that they are exposing patients to. And it has to stop, Stephen. It's a management
issue. We can see in this report about the private ambulances, it pointing out that they're unregulated. They're obviously providing an important service because they're being used by the health service more than ever before. We can see that.
Yeah, but they should only be transferring stable patients between different hospitals, Stephen. So they have the equivalent translatable, I think it's St. John's ambulance skills. You know, they can give you oxygen and they can do CPR. But if you're a surgical representation, you're going up the road for hours. And it is the case. There's not a note taken on you in that private ambulance. They're not qualified to either take a medical handover from the original hospital or to give a medical handover to the receiving hospital. And you're under their care, assuming that you have the best possible care. But it isn't. It's not safe. If it says emergency transfer on your form, you're entitled to paramedics.
We need to be careful, don't we, when we're talking about things not being safe within the health
service.
Well,
I just know the impacts of them, Stephen, and we've lived them.
Sure.
So therefore, they're very real. It's not an opinion. Okay. That's why I wouldn't have phoned you without it being
a personal experience. I hear you. No, absolutely. You know? And look, your personal experience is invaluable to us on the programme. It really genuinely is. And
I do want to reinforce what Sid said at the beginning. The frontline staff in both SWA and in Altney Galvin and the paramedics that we have had on two of the journeys that we've had, they have been immense.
Well, that scene that you depicted, though, of your dad getting that examination in a cupboard,
no clinical concerns for a post-operative care on an 86-year-old man. It was just horrific.
It sounds it. Helen, thank you so much. Thank you. Morning to you. 24 minutes past 10, 030-30-80-55-55. Some news that we're noticing this morning. Manchester United have announced plans to build the biggest stadium in the UK. They describe it as an iconic new £2 billion 100,000-seater ground close to Old Trafford. The club has just posted a video on X with the tagline, "This is your future, your home, your United."
Manchester. A city. A stadium. A skyline. Risen together. Manchester and United. Forever entwined. Youth. Courage. Success in our blood. A glorious history. a future to be written. Where workers once grafted, a new landmark will rise. A new theatre for dreams to come alive. A design inspired by the Red Devil's trident. A modern take on our industrial roots. 100,000 fans, united as one. A place for glory, a place for pride. A sea of red, the loudest crowd. A majestic arena where history and future collide.
The chief football writer at The Independent, Miguel Delaney, with us this morning. Was this expected, Miguel?
It had been bubbling, yes. Now, I suppose it does clear up one uncertainty, which is about what they were going to do at Old Trafford. That's been actually been hovering over the club for 15 years, and especially over the first year of Ratcliffe's tenure. There are still a lot of questions in the statement. I mean, the biggest is, how is this going to be funded? Especially given it's, you know, close to $2 billion. What's the most striking, really, it's quite a significant leap to go from headlines on Monday evening about how we were going to go bust by Christmas to the announcement of a $1 billion-plus stadium the very next morning. Maybe a little bit more clarity on one end, but a whole new questions on another. And just as we're speaking, actually, I've just on my inbox here, I've just seen a statement from the Manchester United Supporters Trust, who literally talk about how everyone wants the biggest and the best for our club, and the visuals look both stunning and exciting. But against the backdrop of uncertainty around next year's ticket prices, continuing poor performance on the field, speculation around sales of key young players, and recent financial results, the news probably does beg more questions than it gives clear answers. And that's my own overriding impression. It looks very glossy, but there's still maybe the impression that it feels a little bit superficial at the moment.
Well, the co-owner, Sir Jim Ratcliffe, we notice and we note that he has said that the government will have to be involved in this. So how much of taxpayers' money will be put into what is essentially a private enterprise, but look at the benefits there could be for the local economy. And he has also said about the current statement, Miguel, hasn't he, that ticket prices will have to go up a little. How much would ticket prices go up to pay for this?
Well, this is it. I mean, and if you look at other clubs who've been in similar situations, Tottenham, true Arsenal. I mean, Tottenham, okay, it is in London, but they've got among the kind of biggest ticket prices, or the largest ticket prices in the league. And part of that, of course, is to actually fund the club, having gone through these expensive redevelopment programs. And look, of course, like, clubs have to go through this. I mean, I've been to Old Trafford so many times. There is just that. It's one of those stadiums like the Bernabeu. Part of its mystique, apart from how kind of grandiose and spectacular it is that when you're sitting there, you're aware that actual football history happened in this stadium. But it clearly needed something to be done with it. I mean, you can't kind of latch onto these things forever. I do think something will be lost. Clubs do have to go through this still. But yeah, again, your point is, it's just one of many questions that come out of this. If you're going to go through this this sort of upheaval, we probably need a bit more clarity on what next.
And all of that heritage that you're talking about with Old Trafford, it sits awkwardly with what's happened in recent times, where, you know, it was raining and there was water coming through the roof.
Yeah, now it's funny, actually. I was speaking to someone at the club who was very defensive about that, saying it was a flash flood. These things happen in flash floods. But of course, with a situation like that, it's all about the symbolism and the imagery, especially, you know, what's happened to the team on the pitch. But it's funny, this whole issue. I mean, I did a piece a few weeks ago when United went to Spurs. Because, I mean, Spurs is now considered, Tottenham Hotspur Stadium is considered the best stadium in Europe, the most sophisticated. It's a massive revenue driver because of all the events it can stage. And I know the original tagline for United had been the Wembley of the North. What they really want is a Tottenham Hotspur Stadium in the North. Because really, I mean, I think we're at an interesting point in kind of football financial history in that way, where if you speak to people, the main new potential income is actually stadiums. It's come full circle because broadcast revenues leveled out. Owners can't invest in PSR in the same way.
All right.
So it's stadiums. And this is, where they have to go.
Miguel, thank you very much. Chief football writer at The Independent, thank you. So a £2 billion, 100,000-seater ground at Old Trafford. They'll still have to play better in it, won't they? See you tomorrow.
Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @Stephen Nolan.